out here. We expect it to work in flight, but there are enough redundant communications modes that even if it does not work, we would still fly a perfectly safe mission.
This should be addressed, I suppose, to Dr. Berry. There was some organ damage reported among the turtles and other small critters that went on the Zond 5 and 6 flights, I believe. And also, I'd like to ask whether or not there are any unusual or new kinds of before and after blood tests that are being made on this flight.
We don't really know the details of those findings, Dick, except for what we've seen in the press reports that were put out. The turtle is an unusual animal to use for this type of research, and I think that some of the reports that we have seen lately imply that the Russians are perfectly satisfied with that damage and are not sure that it's necessarily related to radiation. They have expressed, after their original fears, they have expressed themselves as saying that they do not see any real radiation hazard in that type of a flight, although that was not true in their earlier statement. We have no other blood studies other than those that we were doing on the last flight on Apollo 7. We're doing that same battery of blood examinations as they were done, and they are in the medical requirements document.
Deke, can you tell us what the rest work cycles will be just before they enter LOI, so that you wind up with three fresh and rested astronauts?
Well, I think that's detailed in the flight plan. Our plan is, of course, to have one person awake on board at all times through the whole mission. And as a result of that, we do end up with some rather wild sleep-rest cycles in the lunar orbit part, as you're aware of. If you want the exact numbers, I can dig them out here for you. Hard. Okay, after MCC number 4, which is LOI minus 8 hours, the command module pilot and the lunar module pilot have a 6-hour sleep period. The commander's last sleep period ended just prior to that, and he had a 7-hour sleep period. So the next time the commander gets to sleep then is at 78 hours. And he gets 3 hours sleep at that point. Okay, the next time the other two sleep, they wake up at just prior to LOI number 1. And the CMP gets another short rest period of 2 hours just after LOI number 2, which is at about 73 hours, 73 to 75. The LMP gets another rest period at 82 to 84, 2 hours. All this detail is in the summary flight plan. We can make that available to you if you want to.
We'll take one more question over here and go to your colleagues in Houston for some questions, then we'll come back here again for more questions. This gentleman here.
What's the performance record of the S-4B? How many times has it been fired to foreign space, successful or not?
I imagine you're talking not only its flight performance, but its propulsion system performance. If you look at the engine performances for the J-2 have run, whether they be on that stage or in associated type flights, that would number the equivalent of many hundred flights. If you look at the ground tests as well as the flight tests that this has run, it would be on the order of about 40 or 50. The ground tests complete that are just like this. Now if you add the battleship, which is a related type stage but the thick skin and so forth, we run that several times a week, and so this would run this up to something like 150 to 200 type tests. And as you know very well, the 1B program has flight tested that particular stage, so there have been some five of those besides 501 and 502 for actual flights.
Okay, at this time we will switch to Houston for questions, please.
Are we on? Yeah, this is Houston. We're available for questions, Mr. Lyons.
Could you tell us if weather does dictate a postponement tomorrow morning, what the recycling times would be? There are obviously problems with fueling the booster.
Well, we have a 24-hour recycle. If we get down with the booster, all stages fully loaded, and hold just because of weather, and we do have a 24-hour recycle. Now, the question of the exact time of scrub and the exact time of the next window has to be looked at. But we do have a capability of recycling 24 hours after a scrub and having proceeded to the point of the booster fully fueled with the cryogenics.
Any further questions? Could someone explain how the spacecraft will be rolling in space to achieve this thermal balance? I don't quite understand that.
Yes, I think I can. The idea, of course, is to perform a slow roll rate to get an even distribution on the sun, on the heat. Now, effectively, what we'll do is set the spacecraft up and start a roll rate very slowly and effectively disable that channel of the control authority and maintain what we call a wide dead band and pitch and yaw. And this should be very economical from a fuel point of view. And the result is that you'll have a very slow roll rate, 10 to 3/10 of a degree per second. And we'll maintain this throughout the flight unless we need to stop to do navigation sightings and platform alignments, that sort of thing.
In light of some of the alarming statements that have been made by Dr. Ralph Lapp and others, I wonder, what is NASA's plan of action in event the service propulsion system does not start at the time of TEI? And what, if any, instructions have been given to the crew in that event?
I'm not sure whether I can answer your question in exactly as it was asked, because we intend the service propulsion engine to start for TEI if we have started it for LOI 1 and LOI 2. The service propulsion engine is a highly redundant system. It uses hypergolic propellants, first of all, which do not need a spark plug but are self-igniting. It has, in all of its components, in the valves, in the electronics, in the electrical systems, it has duplicate systems, redundant systems. It has, in terms of mission life, I think even many more hours of test time than Lee James has been able to state his S-4B stage or his J-2 engine has. It's an engine that was developed over the years as a simple engine insofar as propulsion systems go, in that it does not need igniters, nor does it need pumps. It's pressure fed. It is, through its duplicate systems, redundant. It has been tested on the ground over and over again. It has been tested in flight on Apollo 4, Apollo 6, and on flights before that as well. And it performed successfully 8 times on Apollo 7. We have every confidence that the engine will work and perform as planned in this flight.
Confidence also. However, this was a point that was raised by a serious man, Dr. Lapp, for one. It's a question that's asked in all seriousness, and I'd appreciate an answer to the question as asked.
Well, the only other thing I can add to what George has said, as far as any instructions to the crew, we haven't given them any. I suspect they'll pray a lot. I don't know what else to tell them to do.
First part of the question that's still hanging fire is, what's NASA going to do about it?
It's
continue to try to ignite the engine. It can no longer be tried.
Can we get a repeat on that statement from the Cape, please?
I said we will try to continue to reignite the engine until it's no longer possible.
I'd like to point out that the way in which we intend to check ourselves as we go into lunar orbit, I think gives us a better feel for the performance of this particular engine, because you have to consider the engine you're using. It's our intent to probably use the SPS engine for the first mid-course correction. That is dependent upon the size of that correction that we have to make. It's probable that something like probably 80-20 that we will use the SPS engine during that burn. We want to make about a 3-second burn during that period so that the engine experts on the ground can then evaluate the engine performance. They can see the pressurization systems, the way in which the ball valves are performed, the pressurization buildup in the thrust chamber. All those things will give the engine experts a feel for the performance of this engine. Then when we get to lunar orbit insertion, the astronauts again will be, since we're out of contact at that time, but the astronauts will themselves be evaluating the performance of the engine, assuring themselves that they're satisfied with its performance. If they have any doubt about that performance, they will cut it off, and depending on the velocity that they have put into the vehicle at that time, approximately 15 minutes later, depending on that velocity again, take that out so that they're back on a free return trajectory. Therefore, I think we're doing everything possible that we can, both from the ground test point of view that we've already done and from the in-flight test point of view, to assure ourselves that the engine is performing properly before we get ourselves in a position that we cannot then get out of. Now, the question still remains, if you get into orbit and the thing will not light again, then frankly, Bill, there is nothing we can do except prepare ourselves for the fact of trying to determine why it did not do it and make sure it doesn't happen again. I guess that's the best answer we can give.
Any further questions from here in Houston? Switch back to
you. Okay, we're back at KSC at this time. Let's come down here in this row right here, please.
I remember the flight plan right. The first couple of television shows come right in the middle of Borman's sleep period. That seems like kind of a lousy deal for Borman, and I wonder if you could tell me if it's true and what you're going to do to keep from disturbing his sleep period.
Did you hear that, Steve? Yes, we're concerned about having the TV fast at the same time we're sleeping. This, we don't anticipate, is going to interfere with his sleep at all. We don't intend to run any TV productions on this mission. It's going to be the crew option as to what they think will be the most interesting to the public in terms of whether you're in relation to the moon or the earth, and whether we shoot out the window to one object or the other, or shoot internal. But we definitely will not disturb his sleep.
Two questions, please. How long will the astronauts keep on their spacesuits? Will they be able to doff them as during the Gemini 7 mission? And the second question, 11 years ago, before we entered space, before anything was put into space, doctors talked about the breakaway or separation syndrome that astronauts might experience on literally leaving their home planet. Do we still consider this anything of a hazard, Dr. Berry, please?
As far as the suits are concerned, we will take off the helmets and gloves after insertion and prior to TLI. However, leave the rest of the suit on until we have accomplished TLI and separation. The suits will then be removed and stowed, and we do not intend to use them for the remainder of the flight, assuming that we maintain cabin pressure. Of course, if we start having problems with the cabin pressurization, the suits will be put on again. But the nominal mission, we will re-enter with the suits off.
Well, as far as this breakoff phenomenon is concerned, we have seen no evidence of this in any flight to date. This was a syndrome that was really developed even with aircraft, and it was elaborated on the basis of aircraft experience, and we have seen nothing to confirm this, and I personally don't believe that there is such a thing.
Go ahead, sir.
I wonder if Lee James could go into one thing. Does this, or rather Rocco, this oxygen contamination problem experienced last night, does this suggest in any way that you might experience the same kind of trouble when you load cryogenic propellants?
Load into the launch vehicle?
Yeah.
No, not at all. Not at all related. No way.
Two questions. First, have you asked Sir Bernard Lovell to come and watch the launch?
I'll check our list, Reggie. I do not know myself.
Well, the second question is a more serious one. If they do get stuck in lunar orbit, have they got any EVA suits, and could there conceivably be a situation in which they could get outside the spacecraft to put something right that had gone wrong?
Suits do allow us the capability to go EVA. However, I think it's a very remote possibility that you'd be able to get out and play mechanic on this vehicle. We're not prepared to do that. I think all the redundancies are, as George indicated, are built into the system to be handled on board internal to the command module. And what we can't fix there, I doubt very much whether it could be fixed in EVA activities.
They have got the capability to get outside.
They have the capability to get out, but I don't really know what they'd do after they got out. I don't think we'd recommend it as a procedure.
Dick, behind the scenes, how are the astronauts expressing their own personal excitement about the trip? Are they exhibiting any nervousness, or what kind of quotes are they handing out among themselves about it?
Well, they're a fairly serious crew, but they're at this point very relaxed and ready to go, and they're looking forward to the mission. I think they're going to be much more relaxed when they get through TLI. That's the thing they're most concerned about, is getting to that point. I think if they get there, they'll be very happy. I don't quite know how to answer your question about quotes. I can't come up with any that are of any great significance.
Two questions. One, behind the scenes again, all of these missions are dangerous, and you do leave women behind. Have you done anything extra special because of the extra specialness of this mission to help the wives over the hump, so to say? And two, what are the hours Sunday for the window, from when to when? Because you're liable to have the same weather at 7 o'clock Sunday morning.
Right. I get it.
Well, the first question, no, we're not doing anything special about the wives, and I guess from a crew point of view, we don't see that this mission is all that special. Every one of them requires a lot of effort, and there's a certain element of risk involved in every mission. And I think this is one of our most ambitious missions, certainly, but we've flown a lot of ambitious missions before. We don't attach that significance to this one.
Window on Sunday would be approximately 920 to 1400.
If this nitrogen contamination problem is sufficient to make you consider the possibility of a scrub, could you elaborate a little bit on what it is about the nitrogen in the system that makes it such either a hazard or a glitch?
The nitrogen in the system is not a hazard in itself, but it prevents the oxygen, which is one of the two reactants in the fuel cell, from getting to the diaphragm or membrane and reacting with the hydrogen. The fuel cell is a battery that uses hydrogen and oxygen reaction to produce electricity. It flows about a pound and a half of oxygen per hour for normal usage. Now, as the oxygen is used up by the fuel cell, the nitrogen concentration gets to be higher and higher. So before very long, the nitrogen has displaced the oxygen next to the fuel cell membrane. The oxygen is no longer available then to react with the hydrogen, and we can no longer produce electricity. Now, this can be avoided or circumvented by purging fresh oxygen through the fuel cell about once every hour. But we don't believe that this would be a proper way to start on this mission. We have never done this before. We have never flown for any period of time with purges every hour before.
A representative of one of the firms involved in handling the nitrogen and the oxygen loading indicated this morning that the nitrogen in its liquid form is what he called a dirty gas. In other words, it is nowhere near as pure as the oxygen. Is this a hazard to the breathing system, the environmental system?
I think the word dirty there could be misunderstood. You don't want it in there. There are times you want pure nitrogen for other systems. So nitrogen itself should not be classified as dirty. Being where you don't want it makes it that.
It is an inert gas where we want an active gas.
I think on that question also, to emphasize, one part of his question was whether this would affect ECS, the breathing.
No, as a matter of fact, any small amount of nitrogen, we're talking about a half a percent here, would not affect the breathing at all. I believe throughout the entire Apollo 7 mission, we had a nitrogen concentration of 10% or more.
Go ahead.
You mentioned that the contamination was, I believe, 8,000 parts in 1 million. What are your specs on that? What do you call clean?
We would flow in our sample should read 30 parts per million or less. We normally sample somewhere when we buy in a range of 10. These are very, very small quantities. That's why sampling and analysis takes some time to get to these very low levels, but 30 would be acceptable flowing into this spacecraft.
Back up here.
I want to ask Mr. Slayton for a word. What do the astronauts prefer that we call this flight? Do we call it circumlunar orbit? Do we call it orbit of the moon? Or what do they like to have us call it when we're writing our stories?
I think we'd like to have you call it a lunar orbital flight.
Gentleman up here has had his hand up for a while.
Two questions. First, can I ask Dick to give us a run through of the astronauts' activities from the time they get up tomorrow morning to the time they enter the spacecraft? And the second one for Dr. Berry. We're told that the astronauts will be undergoing a G-force in the region of about 6.8 when they re-enter. What effect will this have on them?
First part, if you want your timeline, we'll get them up local time, assuming around account, at 2:36, medical exam at 2:51, breakfast at 3:21, start suiting at 3:56, and we'll leave the suiting room at 4:42, arrive at the pad at 5:03, and begin ingress at 5:11. We have an agreement with Rocco that if they're ahead of the count a bit and we're ahead, we'll step this time up a little bit, but that is the plan. As far as the G loading, I think we should correct you that we don't intend to come in at nominally 4 to 5 Gs, and this is a pretty easy G loading. Chuck may want to say something more on that, but that's relatively a piece of cake in terms of G loading.
We've had G loads, you know, the nominal loads were up to 7 in Gemini, and we obviously have run much higher loads than this. We run up to 12 and even higher in the transverse axis, which we're taking this. The only, there's no problem with that G load at all. The most that you would expect is that you might feel some pressure on your chest, and they've learned to breathe with this very well and have no effect at all.
Don't see any more hands. I brought it up right down here.
No one seems to want to ask this question.
I thought I should. This is not a spy mission, but hearkening back to the Gary Powers mission, there has been some speculation in the public that in the event of the failure to return to the Earth, that the astronauts would carry in their possession some type of a pin or a pill or something like this. Would anyone care to comment on this?
Yes, I would. The answer is no, we do not intend to carry any such thing.
I will take two final questions right here and right here, and I'm afraid that'll have to be it. We're approaching the hour. Go ahead, sir.
What kind of G-forces do you expect at the time of the first TOI fire?
1.6.
The first what? The first?
TOI burn.
It's about 1.6 foot.
TOI?
OI, going into lunar, to lunar orbit.
Into lunar
TOI.
Excuse me, LOI, I'm sorry.
Well, we've got a 20,000-pound thrust engine and a weight of about a third of a G, I would guess. So between a third and a half of a G.
Yeah.
If they have this pre-dawn splashdown and they float around for an hour and a quarter or more in Apollo 8, do you expect them to be pretty well seasick?
I think if the water's rough at all, they probably will be. Our experience has been on egress training and, of course, on 7, that this isn't really a very good sailing ship, and people tend to get nauseated if you spend too much time in there. However, we do have a seasickness pill. Chuck can tell you what that is.
It's Mirazine.
Okay, I have two statements here. Where the Apollo 8 crew may not have the flu, but another gentleman does have. The statement goes as follows. A prolonged bout with influenza has forced Vice President Hubert H. Humphrey to cancel his planned trip to the Kennedy Space Center to witness the launch of the Apollo 8 Saturday morning. The Vice President has been confined to the home of former United States Senator William Benson in Phoenix since early this week. One of the Vice President's three sons, Robert Humphrey, will be at KSC representing his parents. And finally, just some information for photographers, and then we'll be ready to complete. If I don't get this in now, they'll all be leaving us. All newsmen who want to cover the astronaut departure, leaving the manned spacecraft operations building, should meet at the news center at 4 a.m. tomorrow morning. Cameraman wanting to cover the launch from the causeway, the NASA causeway, will leave the press site 39, at 6:20 a.m., and cameramen wanting to go to the VIP site for coverage will leave the press site at T-minus 60, and they can return to the press site at T-minus 30 or remain at the VIP site. These announcements, of course, will be made again, but I wanted to get it to you while you're all here. Thank you very much.
Well, I want to comment on the recovery situation there, and I think that wrong impression was given by that answer. It's our intent to put the recovery forces on top of the spacecraft as soon as possible, with swimmers ready to jump. And if we do not get a response from the crew, or we get a request from the crew to recover them, we will do so immediately. It's only that if everything is going well and they're happy with their lot, then we will not put the swimmers in the water until it's light. Now, it isn't. The light situation is also not as the question described it. The landing takes place at 4:58, 4 a.m. Sunrise is at 6:05, roughly, but nautical twilight is roughly 25 to 30 minutes before that. And when it is light, we will jump the swimmers even in the best of the situation. So it isn't. Not quite as bad as that gentleman described. If they are getting sick and they feel badly, then we will go in and get them. And we have every confidence that we can run the operation at night. We just don't want to put the swimmers in the water if we don't have to put the swimmers in the water.
One additional announcement here for the Houston News Corps. The Escape Velocity Press Club Sandwich Bar will be open at noon today.